Welcome to another edition of the Health First Radio Show. Your regular host, Kathy Hardaway, this week. But we do have a couple of great guests. We have a replay, actually. The last half hour, we will have Kathy talking with Brad King about bladder issues. And in just a moment, we'll have Eileen Burford Mason on the phone talking about the healthy brain. But first off, here's Alan with the health news.
Everyday products such as perfume, skin lotion, hairspray, deodorant, household cleaners, and lawn pesticides are a top source of air pollution, as damaging to air quality is the exhaust from cars and trucks, a new report shows. Consumer products containing compounds refined from petroleum all release small amounts of smog-producing particles into the air, the researchers explained. Combined, these products now release as many volatile organic compounds into the atmosphere as vehicle emissions do. Study lead author Brian McDonald said the use of these products emits VOCs in a magnitude that's comparable to what comes out of the tailpipe of your car. He's a researcher with the University of Colorado, working in the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Chemical Sciences Division. The findings were published February 16th in the journal Science. Obese men with advanced melanoma skin cancer seem to have a survival benefit over their slimmer peers, a new study suggests. Among men who received treatment for the potentially deadly cancer, obese patients lived an average of 47% longer than those with a healthy body weight, researchers found. For women, however, weight did not affect survival, according to the study. Study lead author Dr. Jennifer McQuaid said the question is, what underlying mechanism causes this advantage in obese men, and can we take advantage of it to improve outcomes in patients with melanoma? She's an instructor of melanoma medical oncology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. In a news release from the center, McQuaid said one hint may be the interaction between obesity, sex, and outcomes, which has not been detected before in any cancer. The findings were published online February 12th in The Lancet Oncology. If you find yourself famished after you've managed to diet away a sizable number of pounds, you're not alone. Cutting back on calorie consumption is likely to spark changes that permanently boost appetite among obese men and women, Norwegian researchers report. Blame it on the hunger hormone ghrelin, which spikes when you suddenly lower your food intake. It's a phenomenon that harkens back to when early humans had to survive bouts of famine, the researchers said. Now, that ancestral hormonal swing may undermine long-term efforts to keep the weight off, judging by what happened to 35 morbidly obese patients as they spent 2 years on a highly structured weight loss program. The statistics can be disheartening. The researchers noted that only 1 in 5 obese dieters is able to keep off the weight he or she sheds. The findings were published recently in the American Journal of Physiology, Endocrinology, and Metabolism. Kidney stones are becoming more common, especially in women, new researchers found. Better diagnostic tools could be part of the reason for the steady rise in diagnoses, according to Mayo Clinic researchers. By using CT scans, we are now diagnosing symptomatic kidney stones that previously would have gone undiagnosed because they would not have been detected, lead researcher Dr. Andrew Rule said in a Mayo news release. Rule and his colleagues analyzed the records of more than 7,200 residents of Olmsted County, Minnesota, who were diagnosed with kidney stones for the first time between 1984 and 2012. The investigators found that women, especially those 18 to 39 years old, developed stones more often than men. The findings are published in the March issue of Mayo Clinic Proceedings.
Thank you, Alan. Our first guest today is Dr. Eileen Burford Mason, a PhD, a biochemist, immunologist and cell biologist, widely recognized as an expert in the field of vitamins and their appropriate use in health maintenance, healthy aging, and the prevention and treatment of disease. Welcome to the show, Dr. Burford Mason.
Oh, thank you for having me.
First off, your new book is called The Healthy Brain, Optimizing Brain Power at Any Age. The brain, is that the last frontier in the human body where we really don't understand how it works as well as other parts?
Well, a quote that I use all the time, which I love, it says, if the human brain were so simple that we could understand it, we would be so simple that we couldn't.
That's actually a good point. It's always been one of the parts of the book. Well, I think most scientists are fascinated by it. And part of that, I guess, is the fact that we still don't know where thought comes from, do we?
Well, that's true. In the metaphysical sense, we don't know a lot about the brain. But what we've learned in the last 10 or 15 years about the functioning of the brain has really been greatly enhanced by the fact that we can image in real time now what's going on in the brain.
Yeah.
And that's fascinating. It's telling us a lot more about what the brain needs. For example, we can see that if you give very healthy, fit young men very tough intellectual problems to solve, or exercise them hard physically, they will do better and their brain will function better if they have more B vitamins, much more than is recommended in our daily recommended allowances.
Right. Now, the subtitle of the book is Optimizing Brain Power at Any Age. You also talk about pregnancy and a child that's still in the womb. There's different needs for all the way through life, isn't there?
Well, you know, it's really naive of us to think that you can build, you know, a brain out of fresh air. Obviously, in the womb, the brain is developing. You're building a brain, and that can be a healthier brain, according to the latest research, or it can be a more vulnerable brain, maybe vulnerable to depression, anxiety, or even things like autism later in life. So pregnancy, indeed, was an area I focused on a lot, because not just brain health, but all elements of health that looks benefit from optimal nutrition when we're in utero. Those are the most important 9 months of our life.
Okay, so let's talk about that age of a brain. Is there a direct connection from, as far as nutrition goes, as far as what the mother needs and the fetus together? Is it the same thing, or is there different needs for both parts of that?
There isn't different needs. If it's not in the mother, it can't be in the baby.
Right.
The baby is feeding, being fed through the mother. And so what we're finding is that there are deficiencies that we've underestimated in pregnancy, such as vitamin D, for example. The last 3 months of pregnancy, when the brain is growing fastest, are critically dependent on the mother having sufficient levels of vitamin D in their blood. And we do know that many, I would almost say the majority of Canadians who are not taking vitamin D supplements are deficient.
Okay. So vitamin D, vitally important. Is there anything specific for the unborn child that may be different from, say, a newborn or a teenager?
Well, with regard to the newborn continues to have the same needs as the unborn baby.
Mm-hmm.
Probably up to the age of two is when the brain is changing fastest. We're actually born with many more neurons than there is present in the adult brain. Systematic pruning takes place, and the development of neuronal networks, pathways of thinking, take place. And all of that is nutrition dependent. So really, we have to pay close attention to those first few years of life.
Right. If you were to list the top three nutrients, what would they be for the unborn and the newly born child? What are the most important nutrients at that age?
Necessary. That's the problem with nutrition. All of the 40 essential nutrients that we get through food alone or supplements if we take them, they work together. They're interactive. So I can't say you can neglect anyone, but of the prime deficiencies that we know of in the population, I would say vitamin D is one of them. But the other one is the omega-3 fats, the fats we get from fatty fish like salmon.
Right. Okay. Let's take it a step further now. Age two, what are the changes in nutritional needs for the two, three, four, five-year-old that's starting to develop?
Well, they remain much the same. The same range of nutrients are needed. Maybe we get away with being a little less fussy, but the minerals like magnesium, calcium, zinc, very important for immunity. And, you know, the child that has, you never protect, and it's perhaps not even a good idea to protect a child from all infections, but the child who's constantly ill, that's probably an immune system that's underprovided with important nutrients like vitamin C and zinc that are needed for the immune system to function efficiently.
And I guess whenever your immune system is having troubles, that directly affects the brain then.
Well, yes. You see, the thing we don't really, or we've only realized fairly recently, is that the brain is a very sensitive indicator of lack of nutrients because simply it's working much harder. It's working 24/7. It uses nutrients at 10 times the rate of any other tissue. So, therefore, anything that affects the brain affects every other system, and anything that affects another system, like the immune system, will have an indirect impact on brain function.
Okay. So the child gets in through the developmental stages, hits the teenage years, hormones start going wild. Is there something that we need to be giving our teenagers that the brain isn't getting enough of these days because of that aspect of their lives?
Well, teenage years are the years where we have much less control over what our kids eat. And, you know, when they're younger, we have some control over the food that's presented to them. And they can go through a phase of very, very bad eating. And in fact, it can often be a part of rebelling in your teenage years. If parents have encouraged a good diet with plenty of vegetables, etc., it's, oh, I don't like vegetables, I don't eat vegetables. So it's really hard to influence that. You have to do it fairly subtly, and I think you have to begin early on so that good rules, ground rules are laid early on in life. With the changes of hormones, of course, much of that is due to the fact that the kids are growing fast, and as they're growing fast, they're using up a lot more minerals, say like magnesium. And so they need the minerals, calcium, magnesium, etc., which they probably won't get enough of from their diet. The other thing we have to think about is, you know, I feel very sorry for teenage kids. They're going through a period of great stress. We're demanding more from them academically than probably much later in life. We're also putting them, they're in social situations that have their own stressors. They're learning how to be adults. Stress depletes a lot of nutrients, and I talk a great deal about stress and nutrition in the book. You know, things like vitamin C are depleted by stress, and many animals, most animals, their own vitamin C, but we can't. We have to get it from food. But animals that can make their own vitamin C, as soon as they're stressed, they ratchet up their production to help deal with that stress. So we're sort of really neglecting some of the implications of the stress of the teenage years. It's not the only years that are stressful, but I think stress is a big issue for teenagers.
Okay. We're going to get back to stress in a sec. I just want to ask one other question about the teenagers. You talked about how the body needs so much more minerals at that stage of their life because they're growing so rapidly. Does that end up then, is what you're saying is that ends up robbing those minerals from the brain because it's not using it or it's being utilized so much in the growth aspect?
It doesn't. It's just not enough left over circulating. If it's going, it's been divided among too many different pathways in nutrition. Yeah. So that means that there's an undersupply to the brain.
So a mineral supplement probably is vitally important for teenagers.
Well, minerals like magnesium, for example, that's used up in, you know, it's important for bone health. It's important to give bone strength. But it's used up under stress. So one of the prime signs, there are three sort of prime signs in the brain of magnesium deficiency, anxiety, depression, and insomnia. So many of our teens are going through periods of great anxiety, and so they could be helped with additional magnesium. And in fact, it's estimated that about 95% of North Americans don't even hit the recommended daily intake of magnesium every day. It's a growing deficiency in our populations.
Okay. Dr. Eileen Burford Mason, hold on the line. We'll be back with you in a moment. We're talking to Dr. Burford Mason about her new book, The Healthy Brain, Optimize Brain Power at Any Age, and we'll be back in a moment.